Well, Kathy, welcome here to Active Voice Radio today. It's a thrill to have you on the line. Thanks for taking time to speak with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, we're here to talk about the book, which is a report by the International Quaker Working Party on Israel and Palestine. The book is When the Rain Returns, Towards Justice and Reconciliation in Palestine and Israel. And it really is about this journey that you took with this Quaker Working Party through the Holy Land. Tell us a little bit about the group who was involved, and tell us a little bit about that trip.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we were a group of, actually, there were Quakers of different persuasions in the group. There were Quakers from the Friends General Conference. There were Quakers from some of the more evangelical groups, from Friends United Meeting. So we had a quite a cross section of Quakers from different groups. Then we also had Quakers from five different countries. We had Canada represented. Of course, the majority were from the U.S. South Africa, Wales, someone that Britain Yearly Meeting sent, and Palestine. So we were quite a cross-section. And in addition to that, we had asked one person from our committee who is of Jewish background to join us, and one who is Palestinian background, Muslim background to join us. Because we were going to Israel and Palestine, and those are two, you know, of the faiths besides the Christian faith, you know, that are represented there. So we thought it was important to have, you know, someone in the group that could also represent those perspectives.
When you took on this journey, what did you expect to do? What did the group expect to encounter on this trip?
Mm-hmm. All the people on the trip had either, you know, been to Israel and Palestine before, you know, were experts on the issues, or were very, very interested in the issues and had been, you know, working on them. In fact, two of the people were very interested in the issues, the one from South Africa and the one from Wales, but had never been there before. So for them, it was their first trip, as well as for one of the people from the U.S. But everyone was very interested, and people were chosen on that basis, that, you know, to represent different Quaker groups, to represent Quakers in different countries, and also on the basis of their expertise, you know, and interest in the subject. So so that's how we got people together.
Now, you lived in Jerusalem for 9 years, so you had some experience of what the environment there was like.
Mm-hmm.
What were the folks who didn't have that real life experience in the Middle East, were they surprised? What was their reaction once they arrived there?
Very surprised, I think. I think there was one person in the group who just, you know, kept having flashbacks to her experiences before the dismantling of apartheid. You know, there was you know, one person in the group who you know, didn't think it was going to be as, you know, as bad, you know, the situation, but when she got there, she found it was much, much worse than she thought it would be. So when you know, think about, like, what were we there to do, it was, you know, to look at, you know, not only expose people to the issues there, because, like I said, people are already interested in what was happening there. But we were there to as a group examine, you know, what the current situation was, and interview and talk to people, both Israelis and Palestinians, as to what they saw were some of the prospects for peace and where some of the openings for peace could be. So then we decided to write that up into a trip report, but not only a trip report, we also wanted to make it something that was that also had some substance to it, like, you know, that talked about some of the issues in you know, involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So that's how we then proceeded from using the trip report as a basis, but to also use it than to, you know, to educate people about the issues and the things that we had seen and in some cases not seen. And
in the book, you talked about some very interesting methods of containment I had never heard of, with the new highways being built in Palestine that the Palestinians are not able to use, only if you have special license plates on the cars, and also approaching some of these Palestinian towns that, from what I can glean in the book, are quite literally surrounded by dirt and stone barricades and have had the roads that go in and out trenched up. Now, this was in 2002. I assume this is the type of thing that continues to go on there.
Oh, it's just gotten worse. I mean, when I was there in 2002 with this group, it was very difficult. And by the way, we never did get into Ramallah. We never met any of the, you know, Palestinian NGOs in Ramallah. We, you know, because of the curfews and the closures. So we weren't able to move either. But it's even worse for Palestinians. Another thing that has happened is, for example, Jericho, a couple of years ago was completely surrounded by a ditch, you know, so that no vehicles could get across. So there was only one place where you could get in and out of Jericho. And this happened also, the Israeli army was digging ditches around other Palestinian cities, you know, in the West Bank. And it was a way of keeping people in, you know, inside and from moving. Then there were places that we walked to. We had like a taxi or a public taxi or a bus take us up to a certain point. And then we'd, you know, be facing this huge mound of dirt. And we'd see people just, you know, walking over it, and which meant that the entire road was closed and we had to, you know, walk up the hill and then down again, get into another taxi, a public taxi, and go another distance, and then the same thing would happen. So sometimes, you know, to get from Hebron to Jerusalem, it has taken me 5 taxis to get there, like in and out of vehicles. So, yeah, it's just very difficult to move. It's very difficult. And it's more difficult for Palestinians to move. I mean, it's difficult for us as internationals, but even more difficult for them.
Now, you're returning again to Ramallah to start a Friends International Center there. Quakers have been in Palestine since the 1860s. Mm-hmm. What are your tools for enacting nonviolence in an environment like this?
Well, there's, you know, a number of things that I feel, you know, very good about. Let me just begin by saying, because the Quakers have been in Palestine since, you know, the 1800s, and, you know, by the way, established a girls' school there first and then a boys' school after that to give, you know, opportunities, you know, for education to girls especially to start with. In 1910, there was a Quaker meeting established. So there are generations of Quakers who have grown up there, and you know, were born into Quaker families and have remained Quaker. So when you talk about tools, I think one of the best things that I can go there with is equipped to know, or knowing that Quakers have an excellent reputation there, and you know, people respect Quakers. They see them as trying to push their own religion on others, but you know, being very open and free to, you know, to all three of the faiths there. So probably the best tool is that openness, you know, if you can call it that. But, you know, or the best, you know, the biggest advantage I have. Also, the fact that, you know, the peace testimony, I think, is a very important tool that I'm taking with me. I grew up Mennonite, so I grew up a pacifist in a pacifist tradition, and then joined a Quaker meeting in Ramallah when I was there. So I'm a member of the meeting there. So it feels very much like I'm part of a group that I can, you know, very, very well be with and work on, you know, on their behalf and in their name and so on. So, yes, I think I think that's a big plus, you know, that I'm taking with me.
So the both the Israelis and the Palestinians have this experience with Quakers over the years, and do you think that they respond to the message of nonviolence from Quakers in a different way?
I think the whole idea of nonviolence right now, nonviolence as a, you know, as a way of, you know, ending the occupation, has become very, you know, very much more known and popular in you know, as an idea, both in the Israeli and the Palestinian community. There are many, you know, peace groups in Israel, but unlike here, I think when I first went to live in Jerusalem, I was assuming that when you call yourself a peace group, you are, you know, assume that that one believes in nonviolence and pacifism. And that's not true. You know, a peace group over there in Israel means that they are working, you know, for peace between Israelis and Palestinians in their own way, you know. Doesn't mean that necessarily they're pacifists. So I think the idea of pacifism has, you know, is quite a new idea for many. And I'm not saying for the general, you know, population. There have always been, you know, Israelis who have believed in nonviolence and have, you know, have lived their lives that way, and Palestinians as well. But in Palestinian society right now, even though most of the struggle against the occupation since 1967 has been nonviolent, through nonviolent means, it's always the violence that we hear about. So it always feels like Palestinians are using so much violence. But if you look at, if you really analyze, you know, the methods that were used during the first intifada, and it's changed a little bit during the second intifada. There's been more violence because of the guns, you know, available and so on. But even at that, you know, most of the resistance has been nonviolent. Now, Palestinians are at this point saying, but if, you know, if we have used nonviolence in the past, and we still have not gotten rid of the occupation, what does that mean? Well, maybe, you know, we need to organize into, you know, look at what are the nonviolent strategies we want to use as a whole, maybe not just as individuals or as, you know, as groups, but as a whole people. And that's been more where Palestinians have, you know, are going in their thinking. What does it mean for their society as a whole, using nonviolence as a way of ending the occupation?
Let's talk about some of those interviews that you conducted and about what some of those people said about what they thought solutions for peace were. Because I was amazed at the conclusion to this book. You encountered and will again and still exist these tremendous physical and spiritual and in many ways psychological barriers between the two populations. Mm-hmm. But you did find these very interesting interconnectivities between the two as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, Palestinians and Israelis could have a wonderful life together if it wasn't for the political realities. In other words, if they each had their own state, you know, where they could, you know, empower themselves, if one wasn't, you know, oppressing the other, I think... You know, I mean, look at Israel. It's a rich country in terms of, you know, its culture and heritage. And I mean, look at how many countries do Israelis come from? I mean, it's just a center for so much, you know, potential. And when you look at, you know, Palestinians, I mean, you know, Palestinians have, you know, they're very hardworking people. They've been in that area for generations. They know how to work the soil. They're very well educated. I mean, they're the most educated in the Arab world because they see, you know, education as a way out, you know. So I think the two people could live together absolutely if there wasn't this political reality between them. And that makes it so sad and also very disgusting to think, why are people kept apart? Why is there so much killing going on? I mean, there are so many senseless killings because of this, you know, the occupation. And when I think the place could be flourishing. I really do. It's a rich country in terms of soil. The possibilities are endless.
In just a couple of months here, you're headed back to Ramallah, and I want to ask, well, first let me ask, what are you looking forward to? Having been there before, there must be some great things to look forward to. Anywhere I've ever traveled to, I think back with these memories and think, there's nowhere else I could get that experience of that happiness or that view. Tell us about your best experience there in Ramallah.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that I really look forward to. I think there's a sense of community, and among Palestinians that is very conducive to to taking people in and bringing them in and making people feel at home. So on that level, I look forward to being part of a community there in a way that doesn't really happen in North America. And of course, I know many Israelis and many Palestinians from when I lived there before and have continued to work with them over the years and in many, many different ways, organizing speaking tours in the U.S. for Israelis and Palestinians and, just being one thing. So I think, that's another thing I look forward to, is to continue working with some of the people that I did before and meeting new ones and new colleagues over there. And I think the other thing that's very attractive to me is to work, to feel like you're really working right at the base where the issues are, It's not two and three times removed. Like here, we work on U.S., we're working to change U.S. policy on Middle East, which is, has become almost a hopeless task. Over there, I'm working, right at the base, at the grassroots with the people, both the people who are suffering and the ones, Israelis who are interested and want to do something about it. So you're very much connected at a very visceral level to the issues.
Kathy, I want to thank you so much again for joining us here on Active Voice Radio today. And I want to express my wish for a very safe and productive trip over to Ramallah in March.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I appreciate very much having this conversation with you.